This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Tensions between the United States and Iran have escalated to a point where war has begun to seem like a real possible outcome. There have been attacks on oil tankers, a U.S. drone was shot down, and President Trump signed off on airstrikes against targets in Iran before changing course after being told that there would be 150 casualties. And who knows what's next in this seemingly heedless confrontation. New Yorker staff writer Dexter Filkins has been reporting from the Middle East for years, and I spoke with him late last week. Now, Dexter, events are accelerating between the United States and Iran in a way that is completely unpredictable. Try to give us some background and context here.
You know, I think it's pretty difficult to divine Iranian motives here. But having said that, the Iranians took credit for the attack, and they said, we don't want a war with the United States, but we're ready for one if it comes to that. And I think what's happened here is the Iranians feel like they've been pushed into a corner by the campaign, the White House campaign of what the White House calls maximum pressure. And that's, you know, maximum economic pressure and the withdrawal from the nuclear agreement. I think they feel like, you know, the White House wants us to come to them on their knees, and we're not going to do that. So what are our choices? And so I think that's what we're seeing here, that they're kind of striking out in anger and frustration.
Now, without underestimating Iran's malign behavior in the region, isn't it really the Trump administration that's initiated this kind of confrontation by canceling our end of the nuclear deal, by putting on enormous economic sanctions that have squeezed oil exports from Iran almost to nothing? Is this something that Mike Pompeo and company wanted to happen?
I think that's a pretty fair assessment. I mean, I think that the difference between the Obama White House and the Trump White House on how they saw Iran couldn't be greater. I think the Obama White House believed that they could make a deal with the Iranian regime, and that, you know, maybe further down the road, Iran could be kind of integrated as a normal country into the international system. And the Trump White House does not believe those things at all, particularly John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, and Secretary of State Pompeo. They don't trust the Iranians. They don't believe that they will adhere to any agreement that the United States makes with them. And so they embarked on this campaign of extreme pressure. And I think that the public name for that is they say, we're not trying to break the regime. We're not trying for regime change. But many of the people who devised that strategy do, and they're happy to tell you that.
Haven't we seen this movie before? I mean, this is a little eerily and sickeningly reminiscent of 2002, isn't it?
Kind of. A senior administration official said to me, we are trying to collapse the economy of Iran, and we think that's pretty easy. We think we can do it. And they may actually be right, because Iranian oil exports, you know, not even a year ago, were 2.5 million barrels a day, already down to like 400,000 now. And, you know, they're going for zero.
But collapse the economy to what end?
I think they believe they can push the Iranians to basically, and this is the public version, we can push them until they come to us on their knees and say, okay, you know, we give up. What do you want? And so they stop supporting Hezbollah. They stop meddling in Iraq. They stop meddling in Yemen. All those things. I think the likelihood of those things happening are pretty close to zero. I mean, anybody that spent any time in Iran with Iranian officials knows how much pride, how much national pride they have. And I it's hard for me to imagine that that's what's going to happen. And I think it's brought us to this moment.
Now, isn't it pretty easy to imagine this leading to almost an accidental disaster, or accidental on purpose? Just incident by incident getting ratcheted up, and a trigger-happy, you know, mid-level officer for the Revolutionary Guard or some military initiates a conflict that gets out of hand?
Yeah, I mean, this is how wars start. Everybody's playing chicken now, and take the downing of the drone. The Iranians claim that drone flew over Iranian airspace, and that's why they shot it down. Whereas the Americans said it never went in there. It was over the Straits of Hormuz. And I think that's how countries miscalculate, because they misread each other's intentions. In the fog of all these events, bad things start to happen.
Did Trump's constant, you know, fluctuations have more strategic value to the U.S. or to the Iranians?
I personally think the Iranians have, for at least a time, I think that they were afraid of Trump. I mean, I think they felt like he was unpredictable and potentially dangerous. But I think that they finally reached the point where now they feel like we don't have any other choice. We accept the strikeout. And that's what I think is unfolding now in the region.
It seems to me there's a very, very basic strategic difference between the Obama administration and the Trump administration. Strip away all the differences in character and lying and politics and all the rest. The Obama administration seemed interested in acknowledging that there were ugly aspects of both the Saudi and the Saudi axis in the Middle East and the Iranian axis in the Middle East. The United States was interested in the Obama's time in creating a kind of balance of power. Here, under Trump, all the favorables, all the ways that we can help one side or the other are on the Saudi side. The relationship with MBS is complete and affectionate. We overlook the fact that he murdered a journalist, and we fund him and we sell him arms and all the rest. Iran is just the complete opposite. Isn't that the real strategic episode that we're going through now?
I think so. I mean, I think you said it right. I think that the Obama White House essentially saw two regional powers, both of whom had ugly aspects that were kind of struggling for supremacy, and we were gonna try to manage that relationship. Whereas when Trump came in, they very pointedly and decidedly took sides, and you know they had a meeting in the White House a couple days after. This is Jared Kushner and the National Security Council. They had a meeting. They sat down and said, "Who are our friends in the Middle East?" And they went to, they said, "Saudi Arabia and MBS, and we are going to support them, and we're going to back them, and we're essentially going to build a wall around Iran." And I think that's what's happening.
Why did they make that determination?
There has been kind of a view which is long, it's been in development for many years, which is that the Iranian regime can't be trusted. It's essentially a supporter of terrorism. It's not really a modern state. It's a revolutionary movement. And so it has to be dealt with. And the Trump White House feels like we're going to deal with Iran in a way that no one else has dealt with them before.
Is there any legal authority under which President Trump could launch a war against Iran? Just how could the authorization of military force bill passed after 9/11 and aimed at al-Qaeda at the time possibly be applied to this situation?
Well, I think it'd be pretty easy if the United States, if U.S. forces came under attack, or we could plausibly claim that they came under attack. And then I think as under his authority as commander-in-chief, I think it would be pretty easy to respond. And then it would just be a question of, yeah, how quickly do things get out of control?
How big a factor is the American election campaign in all of this?
Well, the analysis about the Iranians up until very recently was that, you know, they're going to try to wait Trump out. They're just going to, you know, this is a really bad period and they're squeezing this really hard. but, you know, maybe he'll be gone soon. And so let's just ride it out. And that's changed. I mean, I think that's what we're seeing here. And so it's hard to know for sure, but it may be, I mean, I think it may be that they gave up on that. They gave up on that analysis, which is maybe he's going to get reelected, in which case we've got to deal with this now.
How does the North Korean situation reflect on what's going on in Iran? We started out with the rhetoric of fire and fury and settled into Trump appreciating the beautiful and loving letters from the supreme leader of North Korea. Is that pattern likely to follow here?
It seems to me that it was possible, again, until just recently. I felt like, you know, Trump has made all kinds of noises about making a deal with the Iranians. You know, he sent them letters during the General Assembly last year about having dinner and getting together with Rouhani, the president of Iran, and he's talked about making a deal. And so I think in his heart, that's what Trump wants to do. But I think now, I think that's all fallen apart.
You know, part of the appeal of Trump to his base and to others when he ran was a real antipathy. I don't know if it was real or not, but an antipathy pronounced toward foreign wars. He declared that he was against the war in Iraq, even though it seemed that he certainly was not against it in the beginning, and he wants all troops out of Afghanistan, that he was not going to be a repeat of the neoconservative adventurism, particularly in the Middle East. What happened?
Well, I think that's the mystery here, because until very recently, I felt like, I mean, it's pretty clear that there was a split even inside the White House and certainly across the administration, that Trump himself didn't want war with Iran, but everybody around him wanted to squeeze around very, very hard.
But forgive me, why would you, if you don't want that, why appoint John Bolton and Mike Pompeo to the two most crucial jobs of all when it comes to national security?
It's another mystery. John Bolton said to me in the White House, you know, the president knows where I stand on all the issues because he watched me on Fox News. My own sense was that people like Bolton and people like Pompeo, they're kind of emotionally satisfying to the president. It's satisfying to hear them talk tough. But Trump doesn't want to go down that road. He never has. And so here we are. And so the Iranians are pushing him now and pushing him. And that's where I think the whole calculation might change, because if Trump is pushed too hard or he feels humiliated, you know, God knows what could happen.
What would a war with Iran look like?
I can't even imagine that. I just hope that anything, if it were to happen, you know, any kind of exchange of violence between the two countries would be short and contained, because you know, if things got out of control in that region, that would be, you know, Iraq to Iran to Afghanistan. I mean, I can't
Syria.
I can't imagine where that would end or how it would end.
Dexter, thank you so much.
Thanks, David.
That's Dexter Filkins, who writes about foreign affairs and much else for The New Yorker magazine. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RADIOHOUR at checkout for 15% off.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. One of the very few human rights issues that the Trump administration has shown an interest in is the issue of human trafficking. The president has argued that building a wall, the wall, would prevent kidnappers from taking people by force over the border, which is kind of a Hollywood version of trafficking that, in fact, is very rare. And yet some of the policies the Trump administration has put in place have made it harder, not easier, for victims of human trafficking to seek help. That's according to Jenna Krajewski, who's been reporting for The New Yorker and for the Fuller Project about trafficking. Now, Jenna, you've written in depth about something called a T visa, which most of us probably aren't familiar with. So what is that?
A T visa is a specific kind of humanitarian visa for victims of human trafficking in the U.S. who are not U.S. citizens. And what it does is offer them a way to stay in the country legally. It offers them a path to citizenship, and it gives them a way to have family members from their home country possibly join them in the U.S.
And it's different from something like a refugee visa.
The T visa really recognizes the unique circumstances that a non-citizen victim of trafficking might have in the U.S. So, for instance, it recognizes that a victim of trafficking may have been forced to commit crimes while they were being trafficked, often related to their trafficking, like prostitution, for instance, and gives them a way to be pardoned by the government for those crimes. A T visa was intended for people precisely like this woman I met recently. A couple months ago, I went to Washington, D.C., just outside of the city, in one of these new sort of booming suburbs, just block after block of office building and shops.
I think they're on the, I forget which floor.
I'm there to meet someone I'm going to call Esperanza. We met in a small office. She was with her translator and her lawyer, and I just wanted to hear her story.
Mi nombre es Esperanza. Hoy me da mucho gusto estar con ustedes.
Esperanza is now in her 30s. The childhood she described in a small town in Latin America was poor but happy. She had a big family. They worked in agriculture. She had to start working when she was quite young. When she was 18, she was approached by a man on the street who she described as being wealthy looking. He was well dressed. He said nice things to her. He flirted with her.
Lo conocí normalmente como.
I met him like how you just meet people along the way, in a store or someplace. You just meet people by chance. And so we started getting to know each other. We started talking.
Nos empezamos a conocer. Él me habló.
She was naturally taken with him, and they started dating. After a little while, she moved with him to his hometown, along with her two young daughters, who she'd had from a previous relationship. Immediately, things started to change. When they got to his hometown, he said that he didn't have enough money, and that because he had spent so much money on her, it was now her turn to help make ends meet. She assumed that it was going to be working in a restaurant or agriculture and things like that. But he took her to a hotel, and he said, this is where you're going to be working. And that was her first experience being forced into prostitution.
When I got there, the hotel owner explained what I actually had to do. So they gave me a room, they gave me towels, they gave me alcohol.
En ese momento yo no sabía qué era realmente un preservativo o un condón.
I didn't really even know what a condom was.
Hay ocasiones que siento como...
She stayed in that situation for a few months, and then her trafficker came to her and said, if you go to the U.S., you'll make more money. She had never considered moving to the U.S., and the idea of it was terrifying to her, not just because it was a foreign country, but because she had children. Her children were one of the ways that her trafficker controlled her. He would withhold them from her until she made a certain amount of money. He knew that she was worried about their well-being. He knew that she wanted to see them. And so he used both of those facts to keep her doing what he wanted her to do.
Son para mí lo más preciado. Son para mí el...
For me, they're the most precious thing. They're what sustains me.
El sostén de mi vida son, ellas son como...
These girls are like the cane in my hand that prevents me from falling.
Como el bastón en mi mano para no caerme.
Clearly, you were not able to take them with you when you were forced to come to the United States by your trafficker.
No pude traer a mis hijas.
I couldn't bring my girls with me because it was part of the plan.
In what way?
El plan de ellos, el plan de quiénes.
El plan de la persona quien me traía.
It was part of the plan of that man who was bringing me here.
Did you get to say goodbye to them?
Tuve la oportunidad una semana antes de despedirme.
I had the chance 1 week before I left to say goodbye.
La última vez que las vi solo recuerdo que mi hija.
Last time I saw them, I remember my daughter said to me,
¿Por qué ahora no pasas más tiempo con nosotros?
Mom, why don't you spend time with us anymore?
No supe qué responderle.
I didn't know what to say.
Solo recuerdo que dije que las amaba y no importaba
I just remember I told them I loved them.
Lo que fuera a pasar en nuestras vidas, tarde o temprano iba a volver con ellas.
And no matter what happened, I would come back to them sooner or later.
Y estaríamos juntas de nuevo.
And we would be together again.
You may be thinking that Esperanza's story sounds really familiar, and that's because many, many people are trafficked in the U.S. every year. Some are sex trafficked and others are labor trafficked. Some are citizens and some are not. Some cross the border on foot, others come in through legal ports of entry. Since trafficking is notoriously underreported, it's virtually impossible for us to know how many people are being trafficked in the U.S. But in 2000, Congress came together and passed a bipartisan piece of legislation called the Victims of Trafficking and Violence Protection Act, otherwise known as the TVPA. And that was really important because what they were saying is, we don't know the scope of trafficking in the U.S., but we know it's a huge problem and we want to help survivors. One of the most important things the legislation led to was the T visa. Martina Vandenberg is the founder and president of the Human Trafficking Legal Center and was someone who really pushed for the TVPA at the time it was being drafted.
It was a coming together of experts from, you know, across the spectrum, people expert in domestic violence, people expert in migration, people expert in human rights, people who had been serving trafficking victims, although they weren't called that then.
What were they called?
You know, they were called victims of, you know, victims of servitude or victims of involuntary servitude. It was the sort of crime that had no name, really, because trafficking at that point, people thought trafficking was something that happened in Nepal. Mm. It didn't happen here, right? That was some foreign problem that happened in Thailand, not in Los Angeles.
All trafficking victims are in a really perilous situation, but there are certain unique things, unique dangers to non-citizen victims. The T visa recognized that They're in a foreign country. Maybe they don't speak the language. Maybe they don't know anyone. They might be at risk of being arrested for crimes that they're forced to commit because of their trafficking. Maybe they don't have proper documentation. And that gives their trafficker an incredible amount of leverage.
If a trafficker says to someone they're holding in forced labor or forced prostitution, you have no passport, you have no visa, they're looking for you, the police are my friends. If you go and ask someone for help, you'll be stuck in detention for months, and ultimately you'll be deported. So much better, says the trafficker, for you to stay with me and continue this life than for you to go out on the street with no documentation and get deported.
Esperanza crosses the border with a smuggler hired by her trafficker. This is in around 2006 that she finds herself in this situation. She ends up in Queens, New York. And just a warning, what we're going to hear is really difficult. It involves details of Esperanza's day-to-day life being trafficked. So if you're listening with children, you may want to take that into account. In Queens, Esperanza's traffickers have her living in an apartment.
Donde yo estaba era un cuarto con un colchón en el piso.
I was in a room with a mattress on the floor.
Hay dos como dos tipos de trabajo. Uno,
there were two types of work.
En apartamentos.
One where they have you working in apartments.
En casas,
and the other one where it's like delivery jobs.
Como si están repartiendo pizza o comida.
Like if they're delivering pizza or food, they would call by phone and then we'll be taken to the addresses they gave.
How many clients on average would you see a day?
Un día que estuviera... Como cuando en una tienda no entran muchos clientes.
On a slow day, like when no many clients enter a store.
El mínimo, tal vez.
The minimum was maybe 25, 35 clients.
35, 25.
25 to 35, that's an incredible number.
Cuando es un día que no hay según casi nada, eso es lo que
on a day when there's almost no work, that is what it is.
Pero cuando los días son,
but when the days are busy,
se hacen más de 50, 60, 70.
Sometimes it's more than 50, 60, 70. On weekends, it's all day long.
Es todo el día.
Wow, so 35 isn't average.
So, necesita pausar.
Okay, she wants to take a break.
Okay, of course. If you've never been in a situation like this before, you might wonder, why didn't she try to escape? Esperanza was in a city. She was surrounded by people. Why didn't she tap a police officer on the shoulder and tell him what was happening to her? And actually, Esperanza did try to escape once. She left the apartment and then immediately found herself in a pretty terrifying situation. She's in a foreign country. She doesn't speak the language. Her trafficker has told her time and time again that if she tries to escape, she'll be arrested for prostitution. She doesn't have any money. She doesn't have any food. And of course, she's thinking about her kids. And if she escapes, will the trafficker hurt them? So she goes back to the apartment and tells her traffickers that she got lost and that's why she's late.
Una ocasión que me fui...
So given all of that, one of the most surprising things about Esperanza's story is that she managed to escape. One night, she was coming home and something was wrong with her key. She's struggling to get into her apartment building. As she's trying to get in, she sees a man coming up to her. He forces her to a nearby park where he rapes her. She ends up getting pregnant by the attack, and her trafficker is so enraged. He beats her and takes anything that she owns out of the apartment, leaving her nothing. And I think in that moment, with absolutely nothing, having just been subjected to just a whole other level of trauma, she leaves. She walks out. Esperanza makes her way down to D.C., where her traffickers would send her to work sometimes. She meets a man, and she gets pregnant again. And even though she doesn't stay with him, she has the baby. She also goes to a local church, where she makes some friends. And in a real turning point, one of her friends helps her get a job as a nanny.
Nunca me imaginé que...
I never imagined she would pay me to take care of her kids. The first week, she gave me $175 for the two girls. Then she referred me to two other moms with kids.
Just like that, her life starts to open up in this incredible way. That's how it went. That's how I was able to leave everything.
Now I work in construction. I'm learning electrical work. I'm still learning my numbers because I didn't go to school, so that's still hard for me.
She gets referred to a social services center in D.C. called IUTA. And there she meets a lawyer who tells her about this special kind of visa for trafficking victims called a T visa, which will help her stay in the country and help her bring her kids over. She first comes to IUTA in 2016. And 2016, of course, is also the year that Donald Trump is elected president. So the rhetoric around immigration immediately starts to change.
We're taking people out of the country. You wouldn't believe how bad these people are. These aren't people. These are animals. And we're taking them out.
The Trump administration publicly condemns trafficking, and they claim to have made it a cornerstone human rights issue of their administration.
And we're getting it done. Human trafficking is a disaster. Nobody knew too much about it until recently.
Women are tied up. It's been going on. They're bound. Duct tape put around their faces, around their mouths. In many cases, they can't even breathe.
Trump brings it up all the time in speeches. His daughter Ivanka wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post about trafficking. But the way Trump talks about it, it fundamentally misrepresents what trafficking actually looks like on the ground. And the policies that he's passing, like ramping up deportations, like making it harder for people to get asylum, are really just making it that much more difficult for a victim of trafficking to leave their trafficking situation and stay safely in the U.S. And not long after he's elected, the people who actually work on T visa cases start to notice changes in the process. Here's Martina Vandenberg again.
The Trump administration started making changes that seemed small, seemed like tinkering around the edges. If you don't do T visa applications, if you're not dealing with these particular clients, you might not even notice.
Katie Flannery is Esperanza's lawyer at IUTA, and when I meet them, she starts explaining the whole process for applying for a T visa.
So, the first one, this is the application for the T visa itself. It is 10 pages long.
Katie explains that one of the forms her clients often have to submit with T visas has a fee of about $1,000 to file. In the past, the government has usually waived that fee, but under Trump, things have started to change.
USCIS determined that there was insufficient evidence of her inability to pay.
I mean, did this come as a shock to you?
No.
No.
I mean, 2 years ago it would have.
Okay.
But basically every fee waiver that we submit gets denied. It's not clear to me that anyone is really even looking at them.
Hmm. Interesting. So when it comes to evidence for getting the visa?
So the standard for a T visa is any credible evidence. That is USCIS's standard of what is required. So they will consider anything.
Right. And so it's kind of saying we believe the victim. What Katie told me is that the government started sending applications back, asking for more evidence that the person had been trafficked. And you can imagine how absurd and impossible that is for most victims of trafficking, who just simply don't have receipts or leases on apartments, tax returns. I mean, what kind of evidence were they expecting?
Where you just really wouldn't expect there to be a paper trail.
But probably the biggest change in the T visa process involves something called an NTA. If you're not involved in immigration law, you've probably never heard of it. It stands for a notice to appear. And basically, if you get an NTA, it means you have to appear in immigration court. In November of 2018, the Trump administration announced that if you apply for a T visa and you're denied, you may end up in immigration court. Here's Martina Vandenberg again.
In the past, what I could say is if we lose, there's no downside. Because if we lose, the government doesn't go after people. Nobody's going to deport you. You're back in that same limbo that you were before, right? You're still in limbo. The change in the middle of 2018 said any denial, you get a deportation notice. I have not filed a T visa application since November of 2018.
Wow.
So while the administration has claimed to make trafficking a priority, it has made these changes that make it much harder for victims to come forward. Not only is that cruel to the victims, but it makes it much more difficult for law enforcement to pursue, to investigate, to prosecute these cases. I talked with a guy named Greg Dalga, a former special agent with Homeland Security Investigations. How are you doing, Greg?
Good.
Sorry to keep you waiting. He worked on a trafficking task force for years before he retired in 2017. And here's how he put it.
If you think about a drug crime and you say you're driving down the street and there's a kilo of cocaine in the trunk and you get stopped and they run a dog around the car, that's your evidence right there is that kilo. Now, put that over on either the sex or labor trafficking side, and you're driving down the street and you have a 15-year-old girl in the car, or you have two 17-year-old males from Guatemala who are working at some egg farm, and you're putting them in horrid conditions. If they get stopped by law enforcement and they won't talk to law enforcement as far as their predicament or what's happening to them, you have no case. For me as an investigator, but as a person, to know that okay, at the end of the tunnel, somebody on the other side may ultimately sit and say, okay, I don't believe your story, or your story doesn't carry enough weight, and then issue them an NTA, I think doesn't make for a good roadmap to be able to do a criminal case.
The T visa data for Trump's first full year in office was recently released. The numbers show that the approval rate has been cut in half, so now about 35% of the applications are being approved. The wait times have nearly tripled. They used to be under a year, and now they are approaching 3 years. And really importantly, federal prosecutions are down about 20%.
They're shooting themselves in the foot.
Here's Martina Vandenberg again.
If what they care about is trafficking prosecutions, if what they care about is putting traffickers in prison, which is what they say they care about, their prosecutions are going down and will go down further because trafficking victims under these circumstances can't actually cooperate.
Esperanza's application is in. She knows that if she's denied, she might be forced to show up in immigration court, but it's a risk that she feels like she has to take. She has kids in both countries, in the U.S. and back home. She can't go back. She's terrified that if she does, she'll be at risk of violence from her traffickers. But her older kids are still there. Right now, they're with her family. They're safe. But she's worried about their future. She's worried they're vulnerable to the same things that she was vulnerable to. She's desperate to get them to the U.S.
La visa T es nuevamente como una nueva vida para mí.
The T visa means a new life for me.
Una nueva oportunidad para mí.
A new opportunity for me.
La visa T para mí hace recobrar mi vida que he perdido.
It lets me recover the life I lost.
Con una familia completa.
With my whole family.
Cuando decidí hacer esto en un momento, le pedí a Dios que me diera...
When I decided to do this, I asked God to give me wisdom, the strength I needed, to make a decision, a big decision. He's giving me the chance to live many times.
Muchas veces.
From everything that's happened, I don't even know how many films I could make.
Hay mucho.
There is so much.
Esto no es ni...
This isn't even one quarter of my story, of my life.
Ni la cuarta parte de mi historia, de mi vida.
That's the voice of Camila Osorio, translating for the woman we're calling Esperanza. Jenna Krajewski is a journalist for the Fuller Project, which reports on issues that impact women globally. And she contributes to The New Yorker as well. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Andrew Sean Greer won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction last year with his novel Less, about a man in a midlife crisis of pretty devastating proportions. We asked Andrew Sean Greer to pick a story from The New Yorker's archives to read for our fiction podcast, and he chose a story from the 50s about a supremely embarrassing afternoon in the life of a teenage boy.
The boy came into the hotel room and immediately it seemed even smaller. "Hey, it's cool in here," he said. This was not meant as a comment on the temperature. Cool, for reasons possibly known in some department of heaven, was a term then in use among many of those of his age to express approbation. It was indeed cool in the room after the hard gray rain in the streets. It was warm, and it was so bright. The many wadded electric bulbs his mother insisted upon were undimmed by the thin frilled shades she had set on the hotel lamps, and there were shiny things everywhere. Sheets of mirror along the walls, a square of mirror backing the mirror-plated knob on the door that led to the bedroom, cigarette boxes made of tiny bits of mirror and matchboxes slipped into little mirror jackets placed all about, and on consoles and desk and table, photographs of himself at 2.5 and 5 and 7 and 9, framed in broad mirror bands. Whenever his mother settled in a new domicile, and she removed often, those photographs were the first things out of the luggage.
The story is by none other than Dorothy Parker, one of the magazine's very earliest writers, and it was called I Live on Your Visits.
His mother shut the door by which she had admitted him and followed him into the room. She looked at him with her head tilted to the side. "Well, aren't you going to kiss me?" she said in a charming, wheedling voice, the voice of a little girl. "Aren't you, you beautiful big ox, you?" "Sure," he said. He bent down toward her, but she stepped suddenly away. A sharp change came over her. She drew herself tall with her shoulders back and her head flung high. Her upper lip lifted over her teeth, and her gaze came cold beneath lowered lids. So does one who has refused the white handkerchief regard the firing squad. "Of course," she said in a deep, iced voice that gave each word its full due. If you do not wish to kiss me, let it be recognized that there is no need for you to do so. I had not meant to overstep. I apologize. Je vous demande pardon. I had no desire to force you. I have never forced you. There is none to say I have. Ah, Mom, he said. He went to her, bent again, and this time kissed her cheek.
You can hear Andrew Sean Greer reading Dorothy Parker's short story in its entirety on the New Yorker's Fiction Podcast with our fiction editor, Deborah Treisman. Now, I love music, and one of the people I learn the most from is Kelly Fasane, a staff writer at the magazine. Kay has covered a lot of things in his time, politics, sports, but music is never far from his mind. He's enlightened me on everything, on EDM, Christian rock, every variety of metal. But today he's brought in some music that has a slightly larger audience base.
We're talking about some pop concerts I went to, and I might have missed it. I didn't see you there, David.
I missed it entirely.
Was your name not on the list? Did you not make a big enough scene?
I should do that.
These are some shows I was at recently, some pop music shows. The first one I saw, which was totally great, was Rosalia, who's a pop star from Spain you might have heard of. This is a song of hers, her new song. It's from her forthcoming album. It's called Haute Couture, which means, of course, haute couture. We're watching the video, and the video is all about fingernails, of course.
There's a lot of fingernails going on.
Yeah, it's set in a futuristic avant-garde nail salon. One of the things that's interesting to me is, you know, there was a time, not too long ago, when if you had a pop star who sung these songs in Spanish and they'd be talking about her crossing over maybe, the idea would be, oh, crossing over to English.
Right.
And we'll have her sing in English and we'll make her an English language pop star. You know, because Latin music is so big and so varied, she's kind of doing this interesting Spain to Latin America crossover and getting a lot of American fans too without this old-fashioned idea that, oh, you have to sing in English, make English language pop music.
When did that end?
I mean, this is something that's changing just now. I think it has something to do with the rise of streaming and the fact that people are hearing stuff through Spotify rather than through radio stations. And it has to do with the huge popularity of Latin trap music and reggaeton.
But what you're saying is that more and more monolingual people, people that only speak English in this case, are listening to Spanish language music without any hesitation in a way that they weren't before.
Yeah, I think it's probably easier if you're not a Spanish speaker to sample something like Rosalia and get into it through a streaming service, whereas maybe in an earlier era you would have had to hope that a radio station was playing it or you would have had to maybe gamble on buying the
or
album.
Invest, yeah.
Yeah.
So who else did you say?
So this is Kim Petras. She's a German singer now based in America. Her image is very glamorous and slightly goth. This is her song Personal Hell, which, you know, owes a debt to Tainted Love by Soft Cell. Mm-hmm. The name even kind of, and the beat kind of evokes Personal Jesus by Depeche Mode. And so she's kind of working in the kind of gothy margins of pop music. You know, there's this irony about pop music, right? Which is that this sound, which is a very kind of like what we would call a mainstream pop sound, isn't necessarily what mainstream pop sounds like right now.
How do you
right? mean? Well, in other words, the most popular acts in America are more likely to be sort of hip-hop influenced. Maybe it's Travis Scott or something. You know, the big song would, you know, maybe it would be Lil Nas X, you know. There's a sense in which pop isn't quite so pop as it used to be. And so you find these kind of marginal pop performers who are still working in this idiom, but aren't necessarily at the top of the chart.
What was she like as a performer on stage?
She was great. She kind of like spoke softly between songs. The crowd was just screaming the entire time. And, you know, she has, I think there were three different outfits. So there was outfit changes. I always love seeing those big pop production shows on a small club stage. There's something great about that.
So, Kay, what is your third song, your third performer?
My third performer is Julia Michaels, who I also saw earlier this month. She's from Iowa, and she's been a singer and a songwriter since she was a teenager. And she has a kind of a double career. She first got established as a songwriter, writing songs for Selena Gomez and other people, very popular people. And then a couple years ago, she decided she wanted to be a singer-songwriter, too. And so she started releasing her own songs. This is one of them. It's called I Miss You, which is a duet with Clean Bandit, an English production group.
Now you're on Cabo, hanging with your brother, wishing that I was your bridal, so I could be close to your lips again. I know you didn't call your parents and tell them that we ended, cause you know that they'd be offended. Did you not want to tell?
Now, what is she coming out of?
Well, you know, she's cited all sorts of influences, right? Fiona Apple, mainstream pop. You know, the thing I hear in her is also emo. Her music is incredibly emotional, and that's kind of her calling card. At her show, at one point, she declared the concert, the Bowery Ballroom where the concert was, she said the whole room was a safe space and got huge applause. I saw there was one guy at the concert wearing a T-shirt that said, "Treat people with kindness." And so it's a kind of super emotional, super earnest, and she sings these breakup songs that sound a little bit political, a little bit heartbroken. One of her newer songs is about the fear that she has that she breaks up with people just so she can write songs like this.
I went up in the pictures, so I hardly ever took them. Got them saved in my mind from the bedroom, so that way I can't forget your skin. So I saved all the texts, all of the best over the years.
Just now, as a guy of no, well, you're no longer 25, let's put it that way.
That's correct.
How deeply do these
songs... You've Googled me.
Yeah, exactly.
We've known each other that long.
How long can these things have the same appeal to you that the way songs would penetrate when you were 20, 25 years old?
Oh, I'm just as... I get just as obsessed
you
as I ever
You get just as
did.
Choked
yeah,
up.
Yeah, absolutely.
I miss you, yeah, I miss you.
I don't know, when I'm listening to a song like that, that's part of the fun of it. There's a certain kind of energy that you get from someone who is or who is claiming to be sort of laying themselves bare, you know, that you don't necessarily get from different forms of expression. And obviously there's lots of ways to make music, but this is one that's traditional in a sense, and there's a reason why this tradition sticks around and keeps getting kind of reinvented by every generation, is because it's a way to tap into the energy of that kind of emotional exchange.
Kate, you have really little kids. Have they started listening to pop music?
They're not that interested as of yet.
They just give you the side eye.
I'm sure they'll find something to be into that I just don't understand.
Yeah.
That's my hope anyway.
That's the whole game. Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kella Fasana, music obsessive and staff writer at The New Yorker since 2008. If you want more information on what we listen to, you can find it at newyorkerradio.org. And that's it for today. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Andres O'Hara, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Meng-Fei Chen and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.